Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solari Report. It is a real pleasure to welcome back a guest we've had on before, Chuck Marone, who is the founder and president of Strong Towns and is the author of a great new book. I want to recommend it to you. It's called Strong Towns, A Bottom-Up Revolution to Rebuild American Prosperity. It's the real Make America Great Again. Chuck's an engineer. He's a land use planner. He has many decades of experience. He holds a bachelor's degree in civil engineering and then a graduate degree, a master's of urban and regional planning, both from the University of Minnesota, where he lives with his wife and two daughters. He hosts the Strong Town podcast, and he's a primary writer for his Strong Towns website. It's got a wealth of ideas and information for building local communities. I recommend you check it out and sign up. And he has presented these concepts in hundreds of cities and towns across America. So this is somebody whose work and ideas have emerged from very extensive grassroots, bottom-up experience with working with communities and budgets and real people doing real things. So, Chuck, we had a great discussion with you on the last Solari Report, and I'm very happy to welcome you back. Welcome to the Solari Report.
Catherine, we absolutely did. It was a lot of fun, and I got so much positive feedback from my time here. I'm just very grateful. Thank you.
So, one of the things we discussed last time was your discovery of basically the failure of the growth model, particularly when it came to infrastructure. And I encouraged all the subscribers to read your wonderful piece on Lafayette, Louisiana. So maybe if you could just quickly refresh your discovery that federal grants were bankrupting communities. I'll say it that way. So tell us a little bit about Lafayette and sort of when you came to shift into starting Strong Towns.
When I try to walk people through this in chapter 3 of the book, because it was a process for me. I was an engineer and a planner, and I was working on all the projects that city engineers do, building sewer and water systems, new developments, big box stores, strip malls. I worked on an Arby's and a Home Depot, and I thought I was growing a strong America. I thought I was building my city to be prosperous and to do really well. I started to be involved in the project development process. And in that process, I was involved in asking some hard questions. Questions about when we spend this much money, how much do we get back? And I started to run some numbers, and they weren't very hard. I mean, this is actually pretty simple math. The city is going to spend this much, and then, you know, the tax base will grow, and that growth produces this much revenue, and how do those two numbers compare? And when I did that, the math was always ridiculous. And by ridiculous, I mean we would recoup 10 cents, 15 cents on the dollar. But
right.
The retort was always, well, the federal government's paying, you know, 80% of this project or 90%, or, you know, we're getting a grant for whatever percent from the state. And so, you know, don't worry about that, Chuck. Like, it's not a big deal. I actually ultimately started looking at even projects where, developers were doing them. They would come in and pay 100% of the cost. You know, they would have Wall Street financing or what have you, and they come in and, you know, build out these big subdivisions and put in all the infrastructure. And then the city would just take it over. Like, okay, we get this free road. Now it's ours to maintain.
Right.
And when you look at that, the tax base would grow and the city would get lots of cash and they'd get lots of permit fees and everything worked out really well until the bill came due and until you had to go out and fix that stuff. And when you did, it was a financial catastrophe. And so I started to just run the math on these projects. And at first I didn't believe it. I mean, I literally did not believe what I was reading. How could this possibly be true? Because if it's true, every city in the United States is bankrupt. Like, how is this possible?
Right.
And then I ultimately came to realize that, you know what? Every city in the United States is pretty much insolvent. I mean, they're pretty much overwhelmed with liabilities without enough tax base and resource to actually sustain it. And that's the story of the book.
Right. And, you know, it's funny. I told you the story of the one government official looking at me when I was proposing to do something that optimize local equity instead of, you know, continued some of this. And She said, but how would we generate fees for our friends?
Right.
And it's almost a development model based on you get more fees for building things than you do for building people.
Yeah. At the end of chapter five, and I know you read this part about New Orleans, after Hurricane Katrina and Rita, New Orleans itself was devastated and still has not recovered fully from that devastation. People who had wealth in that community had that wealth destroyed and have really never recovered. But if we look at federal GDP statistics, you know, how do we pay our friends? GDP went down in the quarter immediately when Rita and Katrina happened. There was a big hit to the economy. But in every quarter after that, it was a massive offsetting gain. Very quickly, the GDP made up all its losses and then has had years and years of, you know, positive growth from that destruction.
Right.
On the one hand, you're talking about the wealth of people, the wealth of individuals and small businesses was destroyed. But from a macroeconomy standpoint, all our friends got paid. You know, we got a lot of transactions, a lot of work. And if you're worried about that, Katrina was a good deal.
Right. So there's winners and losers. And they're, you know, the people who lose the wealth on the first round are not necessarily the people who gain the wealth on the second round. There's a shift.
Right.
Right.
Yep.
There's a shift in equity. And traditionally, when I do these analyses, which is very different than the way you approach it, but I think it comes out of the same place, you know, you have the locals losing and large corporations winning. So there's a regular sort of sucking sound into the stock market of corporate activity, but it doesn't necessarily optimize local wealth, let alone the local environment. And I think that's part of the environmental problem.
I absolutely agree with that. We've created a system that is predicated on the number of transactions we can do. How quickly can we transact? What's the money velocity in the economy? How does that go into GDP growth? And we've reoriented local government, which, let's be clear, I mean, my version of local government is basically how we in a community work together to get things done.
Right.
Local government's no longer oriented. And I think you could go back 100 years ago and say it was. Today, it is not oriented towards the people of the community. It is reoriented to be, in a sense, a cog in this larger macro growth machine. And so the city hall, instead of focusing on people, focuses on the capital flows.
Right. So it's focusing on federal and state grants.
What's the money from the federal and state government? Yep. And then what money can we get through the development industries from corporations and large developers? That's how you run a local government today.
One of the comments you always make and you make in the book that really brings this message home is that Detroit is not a unique situation. Detroit is just going early. Could you describe that a little bit?
Well, Detroit is the model that we've all followed. And I know that's hard for people to get their minds wrapped around because they're like, well, our city's nothing like Detroit. Yes, it is. Detroit, when it was on its way to becoming the Motor City, was the first city really to experiment with what would become the North American development pattern, this unique way that we build here in North America that you won't find really at scale anywhere else in the world. They were the first ones to run the highways through the middle of their neighborhoods, the first ones to create a commuting culture, the first ones to really reorient around this idea of, you know, how do we get the new development? How do we get the new bit of growth? When you take a city and you spread it out over a huge area, driving up the costs of providing ongoing service and then denuding the tax base, you ultimately end up with the insolvency that you see in Detroit.
Right.
You know, Detroit is quite literally 2-3 decades ahead of everybody else. They are the logical destination. And I think cities will, you know, experience that decline differently. I don't think we'll all end up in the exact place that Detroit did. But Detroit is fragile and still is, in the same way that other cities around the U.S. are fragile. And I think it's one of the likely destinations that a lot of cities are going to experience over the next generation.
To give the subscribers who hadn't heard the our last discussion on the Solari report, your analysis for Lafayette, Louisiana showed that if they were going to properly maintain all the infrastructure they built, I think they'd have to raise their property taxes to something from, say, $1,500 to $8,500 a year. Is that
one out of every $5 a family makes? So this isn't net. This is gross. One out of every $5 would need to get sent in taxes to the local government just to take care of what they have, which is insane. Right. Like, it will never happen.
Right. So many, many areas are looking at systematically having to let go of infrastructure, just let it deteriorate or shut it down. Is that correct?
It's funny because if it were that conscious of a choice, I think it would be one thing. But what happens is that we just create these backlog lists and we say, well, we'll get to it next year, or we'll get to it when the next federal grant comes through, or we'll get to it, you know, at some point in the future. And the reality is these lists continue to grow and grow and grow. And no one's ever making that conscious decision until essentially it's handed to us. Like, no one decided in Detroit that we're going to abandon neighborhoods. They were just abandoned because there was no money to do it. They just fell apart.
Right.
And that's what we're seeing in Lafayette.
Right. And so one of the questions for your town, are you going to do it consciously or unconsciously?
Yeah. Are you going to experience this kind of long decline, as Jim Kunstler calls it? You know, are you going to just allow that to take place in front of your eyes and, you know, pretend it's not happening or make some deal with your future self? Or are you actually going to take some ownership of it and take some steps to in a sense, opt out of the current system and develop something that will put you in a better place? And obviously that's what we're advocating for here.
So, you know, I'm still on the growth model here in Little Hickory Valley because the town has just approved a walking path. There are two or three people here who walk, and we walk on the road, which could use some fixing. We've got more than a few potholes, but the town has just agreed to spend approximately $180,000 putting in a new walking path that's going to be funded by the feds. And we're going to have to, I'm assuming we're going to spend about $30,000 to $35,000 for a 20% match. And I think we could build a walking path just for the $30,000 to $35,000 without the feds. Right. But why are we pouring concrete on the town commons when the government's, you know, we have a serious debt problem at the federal level and, you know, everybody's yakking about climate change. So why would you pour concrete all over the grass, which is quite lovely. So for 2 to 3 people who walk.
It's very sad.
It's very sad.
Yeah.
It's very sad because if you look at what you could do with $180,000 for starting up some of the local businesses that could use some help, or, you know, making sure kids don't have student loans. I mean, I can think of hundreds of ways of significantly increasing local equity, you know, rather than building pouring concrete on the town commons. So, but it's a, you know, it's a perfect example of what you're describing. So it seems alive and well in America.
Yeah.
So let's turn to the growth model. One of the things I loved about your book, there were many things I loved about your book, and I recommend it strongly. One of the things I loved is how you integrated in the financial model. And you tell a story of talking to some town, I think it was a city council, comparing the investment in infrastructure with what they're doing in their pension fund. Maybe if you could tell that story, because I think it brings home the issue.
Yeah, well, I was giving a talk to a bunch of city managers, and this was in Mississippi. So I'm a Minnesotan, and, you know, there's a little bit of a cultural gap there. I got up and I gave my talk and I talked about, you know, the whole Ponzi scheme financing model, how, you know, we got to get more growth to pay for the stuff we put in, you know, a generation ago. And I showed them, you know, how this is human nature and we've done this at writ large and our cities are insolvent and we need to change this development pattern. And I got done. And this is usually the point in the conversation where people have, especially technical groups like that, have very pointed questions for me. And this one guy, and I can't do the impression because I'm not good at the Southern, but he had, you know, his deep Southern drawl and he's like, well, let me tell you, son. And he, you know, he proceeded to lecture me about how they were all doing fantastic. They were doing great. Right.
They were getting lots of free money.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right.
And the one statement that he made that really stuck with me is he said, the investments that we're making here are really solid investments. And so I said, okay, how about this? If the investments you're making are so solid, we don't need to go to the federal government for this money. We need to go to the state. Like, if you're making such great investments, let's take your pension fund and let's redirect your pension fund to basically being the investment capital for these investments. And then if the investments are so fantastic, your pension fund will go way up and you can get a much bigger pension because of your sound management of these projects. And I let that hang in the air for a minute and the room went kind of silent. And this was, you know, like a 3 dozen maybe city managers. And then all of a sudden they started to laugh and like look at each other and like barrel laugh. And, you know, they were high-fiving each other and kind of, you know, oh, okay, you mean that kind of investment? I'm like, yeah, the actual, like, you spend a dollar, you get a dollar back. And their use of the word investment was more like, we're doing the accepted practices of the industry.
Right.
As opposed to we're actually making an investment that pays a financial return. And they grasped immediately that there was no financial return.
Here's the problem. So you have, I'm going to grossly oversimplify, you have two groups of people in America. One group can print money off of a computer and basically borrow at 0%. And the other group on average is paying 17% on their credit card and is trying to optimize their equity, which is even more expensive.
Can I say that a different way?
Sure.
Let me put it this way. And I think these are the terms I use in the book too. There's one group of Americans that experience painful feedback and have to live within constraints. And there's another group of Americans that can forego painful feedback and can live not constraint-free, but with very minimal constraints.
Correct. Well, in some communities, I would say constraint-free.
Yeah, I think in some places, constraint-free. Yeah.
In some places, it's spotty. But that's exactly right. And so you have very two different views of capital, and the ones who have, you know, who are relatively constraint-free can take advantage of their capital funding to basically take over and take over whether you buy the land or take over whether you inflict so many rules and regulations that by the time the project's over, you control, you know, from a distance. So whether it's control or ownership, you know, you've got Richard Mayberry calls it a malinvestment machinery that results in economic activity, which is not healthy to anybody living in that place, whether it's a planner or a person.
Right. I would even take it a step further because I agree with exactly what you just said. And I think it actually extends almost into the cultural realm as well, where
absolutely,
you know, when you live without constraints, you over time lose grip of the fact that other people don't. And so, you know, the whole like, you know, why don't you just code, you know, meme and, you know, the idea of everybody should have a college degree and that's your path to prosperity. A lot of these things arise out of this culture of people who essentially have had the constraints removed for them and are able to, you know, to live in that kind of a lifestyle, which is very different than what most Americans experience.
Well, one of the reasons when I started Solari, one of the reasons why I didn't want to raise capital was capital can make you stupid.
Yeah.
So I was looking for something that would be for profit and could cover its costs. And the thing, you know, when you're losing money, you are getting the intelligence from your subscribers, your customers, your clients that tells you what you need to know to get better. And there's a virtual circle between, you know, the people you're serving and the function. And it's that circle that helps you move towards excellence. And instead, if it's funded with something which is indifferent to the time and the health and the well-being of the, you know, whether it's the people or the living things in a place, you get that incredible stupidity. I, you know, always say people who win in a rigged game get stupid. but you're watching an absence of local intelligence and a spiral down in intelligence, which is really frightening. But, you know, one way to say it is you've got investment pouring into a community which is indifferent to the health and the time of many of the people in that place. And
yeah, this is the story I told at the beginning of chapter five of the primitive farming communities, where they, because they had to live with the consequences of their actions, they, in a sense, became very prudent about what they did.
Right.
You know, if you didn't have enough plots, garden plots, and if you hadn't scattered them in enough places to, you know, give some redundancy, where a localized rain event or a localized fire or whatever wasn't going to wipe out all your food for the year, if you hadn't taken those prudent steps, you could starve. You stood a very decent chance of ultimately dying from starvation. When the development experts come in and they look at this, they're like, oh my gosh, these primitive people are so inefficient. They must be backward. They must be, you know, very dumb and not very intelligent. Yeah. Right. And so, you know, their solution to these primitive people was, you know, we got to educate them and show them how to do things correctly and, you know, get them to be more efficient. When some people with a little more humility came in and said, well, what is actually going on here? They realized like this is actually a survival strategy. And what I didn't really talk about in that particular example of the book, but get into a little bit later, is, you know, the opposite of redundancy is in a sense fragility, but it's also fragility. You know, you become, the more efficient you become, the more fragile your nature gets. And I think a lot of the system that you're describing is one that, in a textbook standpoint, I mean, a big box store is incredibly efficient. A dollar store is a very efficient operation. From a community wealth standpoint, it is, you know, it is the opposite. It's a very fragile undertaking,
right,
that, you know, right, destroys community wealth, which is really the basis of our existence at the local level.
So one of the things that happens is that, so we have these, think of this as two worlds, one with a, you know, without consequence and one with consequence, or one with zero cost of capital, one with a very high cost of capital. If you look at the one with the zero cost of capital, they are now engineering at the federal level a whole new wave of both development and credit that they're planning on infusing. So if you look at the work with Opportunity, I don't know if you've looked at Opportunity yet.
I have, very much, yeah.
Which is very much bringing the Internet of Things into the last mile. Or if you look at the president's new, Mnuchin's new proposal on housing, they're planning on massively increasing federal credit into housing and helping the millennials do housing formations. You know, so you're looking at a new aggressive tsunami of 0% money, at least by certain of the players. And, you know, on the other hand, we have more and more people at the local level, you know, hungering for your message and help to do something that makes real economic sense bottom up. And so I kind of see these two tsunamis coming towards each other, one of them which is based on sound economics and one of them which is basically based on, you know, sort of the federal money machine. And the question, what exactly happens when those tsunamis plow into each other? Which they're doing right now on the ground every day. Yeah.
I started Strong Towns. I started this whole thing as a blog. And I did that in November of 2008. And I'll bet you can guess what that coincided with.
Right.
Kind of my peak frustration. And the peak frustration was, I mean, in 2008, we had banks failing. We had gas prices over $4 a gallon here in Minnesota. We had huge bailouts. We had TARP. And then we had this crazy election cycle where the only thing that the, you know, two major parties in the country seem to agree on is that we needed to do things bigger and more centralized and, you know, financially more top down. And
right.
I didn't even know, there was a part of me that thought, am I just crazy? Like, is there something I'm not getting? And so I started to write this blog. And yeah, as you described, so many people stepped up and said, this is the exact same thing I'm seeing. I'm with you. Like I get this. We need to localize a lot of this development practices for sure. And a lot of the economics that go along with it. What I have seen now through successive presidential election cycles is that we're getting crazier and crazier and crazier in terms of not the places we disagree, but the places we agree at the federal level. You know, our two parties completely agree on the financial model, which is bizarre to me. Bizarre.
Right. Right. Well, they're all making money. I mean, the Dow Jones goes up. That generates capital gains for investors. The capital gains is the source of the political contributions. They make political contributions, and then the politicians do something else that makes the stock go up. And one of the problems that you see, if you have a competition between publicly traded companies and local small business, so back to the 0%, you know, high cost of capital, part of the problem is that the ones trading publicly in the market, at a market that's trading at a 20 times PE, the amount of capital gains they can make by sucking up more net income through their channel, you know, it just goes up and up, and they're trying to compete globally. So they want to make sure every American penny is sucking through their channel. And then you have the politicians who are incentivized through the campaign contributions and the capital gains to do everything from rules and regulations, government contracts, everything else to make sure that everybody locally, you know, they can't issue a community currency. They can't get around that regulation. I don't know if I ever told you this. I tried to get implemented when I was assistant secretary, something called the anti-plan.
Yeah.
And that was somebody at a local or state level could make a list of all the regulations they wanted a waiver for. And we do a jumbo waiver saying, okay, this year you don't have to do these things, or you never have to do these things again. And, you know, cause there are millions and millions of little regulations that just eat up time and money. And, but I could never get it through. And it was funny because it was somebody from the Twin Cities, George Latimer, who had been mayor, I think, of St. Paul. And he looked at it and he said, you know, I just hate to say this, you know, it would save. He was in the room with Secretary Cincinnatus, who was at HUD at the time. And I guess it was when I was working in Hamilton. And he said, this is fantastic. The mayors would love this. This would be so great. But you know, something is completely boring. We could never get a good headline from this.
Right. Right.
Well, I think that's changed. You know, I think the time has come when you could get a good headline from it, but there's no...
The reality is, yeah, we need a lot of boring things right now, you know?
It's that one of the things I love about your book is you make it clear, this is not about a big thing. Right. This is about thousands and thousands and thousands of little things that contribute, you know, so I've always said the way to rebuild the local economy, you know, is one penny at a time on the local businesses. And if you can get the local businesses making, you know, 2 to 10% more every year from little things, you know, you're talking about an explosion of wealth. But
absolutely,
what it means is you're going to have to have a way politically to turn to, you know, sort of the people pushing the growth model in a variety of ways. And get them to stand down. The movie of the year for 2019 was Yellowstone. I don't know if you've ever seen
it. No, I'll check it out.
Well, you have to get to the second season, but it's basically about a land war in Montana between a group of people trying to do various developments and the town and sheriff politics of, you know, who's going to win. And of course, you get into all the political processes, all the dirty tricks. It's amazing. And I my write-up on it said, this is the real deal on going local in America. So
Kevin Costner, even, huh?
You know something? It's written by a guy named Taylor Sheridan, who grew up on a ranch in Texas.
Yeah.
And he's just absolutely fantastic.
Well, I mean,
he's a brilliant writer. Yeah. But it really shows the... you know, the tough issues on trying to get a change in the model. So take a look at it. I'd be very interested to see what you think. So another thing I loved in Strong Towns was you had a wonderful foreword from a former city council member, I think in San Diego. And she talked about, the power of connectivity. And I think the worst thing in communities is not the growth model, but the destruction of trust that the growth model engenders. And with that destruction of trust, you lose that connectivity. So maybe if you could talk a little bit about connectivity, because if you look at the things that create the most equity, including financial equity in a place, they're living equity issues. It's really about people and helping people be successful.
I'm grateful that Michelle talked about this in her foreword, because as an engineer, as a planner, it's not my area of expertise. I mean, obviously I'm a human and I live in a neighborhood and I value connectivity, but I've not studied it like from a science standpoint. I talk a little bit about this in chapter 10 too, towards the end of the book, just how we as humans are co-evolved to live in a certain habitat. When we look at bees in a beehive, we intuitively understand that the beehive itself was designed and, in a sense, co-evolved with the bees to optimize what life is like to be a bee. And if we took a beehive and we redesigned it and reshaped it to optimize, you know, one or two things, you would lose some of that harmony that takes place within a hive of bees that is just natural. For some reason, when we look at human habitat and we look at the way we live and the places we build, and really for thousands of years, there's a lot of similarity between the places we built. You know, you can go back to my hometown of 100 years ago and you can go back to a place of 3,000 years ago. And they're very, very similar in terms of the layout and design and the way a daily life would be lived. That radically changed after World War II. We essentially took our hive, this habitat co-evolved with us, and completely reimagined it. If we did that to bees, we wouldn't be surprised if the bees ended up to be neurotic bees. We look back at ourselves and we're like, well, we have these epidemics of loneliness and depression and suicide and isolation. We have all these problems we used to be able to solve by working together that we now are turning to government and strained budgets to try to fix. Maybe we've just abandoned this habitat that used to work really well for us. And maybe we should try to get some of that back. So I make that case as an observation more than as like a scientific set of findings. Because it's not, you know, I'm not an expert in that, but I think there's a certain logic to it that the finances of the traditional development pattern were also co-evolved and they did work. We've been on this new experiment and financially it doesn't work. I don't think it's a stretch to say there's other dimensions where it's also not working.
Right. So I don't know if I ever told you one of my favorite development stories, but I used to be in a group in the 90s with a group of guys who worked in strategic planning at Hewlett-Packard. And they had gone out a decade or two before and said, okay, we're going to identify all the smartest people in the world and try and hire as many as we can to be in our sort of think group and research and strategic planning. So they'd created a place over in a small town in England where they build a headquarters to house all these geniuses and went out and hired, I don't know, a lot of really, you know, sort of Mensa quality guys. And one of them was a guy named Ian who was in this group. And about 5 years before, they were sitting around and realized that the unemployment rate in their local area was 20%, very high. And so he turned to the group. He said, look, if we're so smart, how come this is going on? We should be able to figure this out. So they did an analysis and discovered that the one thing that they were competitive in globally in their area was a kind of photography, video photographing and photographing animals in the wild. So like the frog on the lily pad, there's a long name for it, but I forget what it is. And one guy had just started it and taken off, and then he hired people and trained them, and then they spun companies off, and they now had four companies. And really, in the world, they were like top in the world at this one thing. So they said, okay, well, this is what our strategic strength is. Let's fund a series of conferences and try and get an institute going where people come from all over the world to learn about this. So they did, and within a relatively short period of time, Ian insisted they gotten the unemployment rate down to like 2 or 3%.
Right.
But they didn't build any buildings and there were no fees for their friends.
Right.
But the unemployment rate did go down. And so part of this is if we're in an environment where intellectual capital is a bigger and bigger portion of the GDP, but we're investing in bricks and mortars, how are we ever going to catch up? In other words, part of the growth model is we're growing the thing that's not growing in the economy. Does that make sense?
It totally does. I think one of the things about the post-war development pattern, and really those two magical decades right after World War II, was that we could go out and build stuff, and that created kind of instant growth. It's a little like drilling an oil well, you know, like right when you drill the oil well,
right,
you get all this oil, and then over time it starts to diminish.
Right.
We have long tapped out that oil well. Think of it like this. I live in central Minnesota. When I was a kid, it was 4.5 hours to get down to Minneapolis, St. Paul. My dad said it was 6 hours when he was a kid. I will get on an airplane tomorrow morning in Minneapolis, St. Paul. It will take me 2 hours and 15 minutes. So we've like marginally cut down the cost, the time cost for me to go to Minneapolis, St. Paul. And you can take me and magnify that over many, many people and all kinds of goods and services. So we've like hyper-connected people. But if we went out and built like another lane on the interstate, or, you know, added another frontage road somewhere, the marginal improvement of our ability to get places is very, very small. But the costs are absolutely enormous.
Right.
From an infrastructure standpoint, like all the stuff that made sense was done decades ago. I mean, we finished the interstate system literally in the late 60s, early 70s. We finished the very last segments, the pesky ones, by the early 80s. Everything we've been building since then is just like marginal, very expensive, very low returning changes to the system. We do need this extended period of time where we say, how do we make better use of this stuff? You know, how do we take what we built and actually wring more value out of it? And that's a equation that requires that painful feedback. You know, if you're not getting the painful feedback, or if the people in a position to spend the capital are divorced from the painful feedback, those adaptations won't happen. And to me, that's what we're seeing right
well,
now.
But it also comes down to, by value, do you mean the Dow Jones, or do you mean political contributions, or do you mean local equity? Because the three are not aligned right now.
Right.
And that's part of what you're trying to do. You're trying to get them back into alignment. So let me turn to some of the risk issues. One of the things I loved was you brought up MMT, Modern Monetary Theory, which is just when you think it can't get more strange, it gets more strange. But modern monetary theory basically says, okay, let's take this malappropriation of investment, you know, and let's double down on it, is sort of my interpretation. Now, you know, they suggest doing a lot of good things, but when you get into development, like wacky things like the New Green Deal, what you're talking about is not only doubling down on the flow of malappropriated capital, but then using it to completely destroy all sorts of rules and regulations that have been good. I would say lawful property rights have been good for, you know, development of the economy. So you're talking about sort of crazy centralized development powers that are, you know, we're not only going to double down on the flow of capital, but we're going to double down on no consequence. So I see sort of the wackiness coming out of Washington on both sides, both Republican and Democrat. I mean, there are various different versions, but this idea that deficits don't matter and that public investment, whether it's channeled through a corporation or government, it's the same thing, doesn't have to have some kind of intelligence vis-a-vis the local capital is pretty scary. I don't know. I didn't know if you wanted to comment on it, but to me, that's one of the big risk issues.
Well, right after the Green New Deal was released, I wrote like 6,000 words on our site about the modern monetary theory. And, you know, I think we can, what I have tried to do is treat it as a serious proposition. And I think the most serious insight of MMT, to me, the one that I would take the most seriously, is that we are living with it right now.
Right.
We are essentially, I think the strongest argument they make is that, look, we have for a long time spent like deficits don't matter. We've racked up debt like it doesn't matter. And so why don't we just admit it and, you know, accept it? And I think the underlying assumption of that is essentially that we are experiencing all the pain we're going to experience from those decisions already. So in other words, there isn't something waiting for us around the bend to kind of make up for the decades of bad decision-making. I think that there is, and I think that's one of the shortcomings of the idea. But if you take the idea seriously, and I try to set this up in the book because, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of people who like parts of Strong Towns who also maybe would like to entertain modern monetary theory and other these top-down centralized financial approaches. What I try to walk people through is just the fact that it is the next step in a process of freeing ourselves from any feedback or any constraints. Imagine evolution in nature where there was abundant food, abundant energy, abundant of everything you needed. What would happen is that there would be no adaptation. And ultimately, and you can find situations like that where, you know, for a brief period of time, resources are plentiful for whatever reason. And that species will essentially have a big peak and a big bubble and then a huge crash. Right. That is what happens in natural.
Well, here's the thing. There's always a constraint on time. In other words,
yes.
If you're going to optimize, the most valuable resource we have as a society is our time.
Right.
So, and our the living things that we enjoy, you know, the planet.
Right.
So if you value the health and the time of all the living creatures and beings on the planet, that is always constrained. There's no such thing as free resources.
Well, and ultimately, I think what we lose sight of in the abstract, you know, economic realm, you know, the Homo economicus and all the theories, is that, you know, money is not a an abstraction that you can just move around. It's actually a proxy for work. It's a proxy for,
right,
you know, resources. And so,
right, so
when you treat them flippantly, what you're doing is you're devaluing human work and you're also devaluing natural resources. And that's, I think,
right,
ultimately what's going to come back, right, to bite us.
Right. And you're, you know, another way to look at it is you're stealing somebody else's time.
Right.
So exactly, part of this comes back to sovereignty and how local towns and cities can enjoy the sovereignty they need to make sure that things are optimized within their jurisdiction. And my concern about modern monetary theory is it's just going to shift even more sovereignty out of the local area and into, you know, somebody or something centralized and distant. So it's more a, you know, centralized versus decentralized. And modern monetary theory is going to end up being used to, you know, further centralize. So go ahead.
I was just going to say, ultimately, that is the kind of triggering thing for me too. You know, I'm not, I've found myself becoming a lot less, I don't want to say sure, but my politics have evolved a lot in the sense that I don't identify with any major party. I did a decade ago. I really don't today. I found myself very disconnected from the national political conversation. And I think if there's,
right,
one thing that I, you know, firmly believe when it comes to national politics is that we need a robust program of decentralization. and not right. in the old Republican style of block grants, but in like a true kind of Jeffersonian style of like, we need local people to have actually power to make decisions. And with that comes the notion that some of those decisions will be good and some will be bad. Right. But I think the idea that we need to have broad toolboxes at the local level, and we need to free people up to learn and to adapt and to, you know, have the power to fix things. If we don't do that, we're going to be in a really bad place.
Yeah, I would say it's a responsibility revolution. We need a responsibility revolution.
I like that.
About
like
10 that years phrase. Ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just think we need to say, okay, we are where we are. It is what it is. We need to take responsibility to reinvent, you know, ourselves and our place. About 10 years ago, a wonderful group of people got together from many sort of different backgrounds here in Tennessee to do a conference called Financial Permaculture. We wanted to take permaculture and integrate it with financial permaculture, you know, or the equivalent, to kind of reinvent how a community could work. And we had sort of, we were in Hohenwald, Tennessee in Lewis County, and we had all the, you know, the serious old-time families coming out of the churches, and then the young sort of greenies coming through the farm. There's an intentional community called The Farm that's really wonderful. Anyway, so we had all these different worlds come together, and we had a wonderful board, and it was really just flying. And then all of a sudden, the Fed showed up and threw a lot of grants at the group, and it split the board right down the middle.
Right.
And killed the whole thing. And yep. Sure enough, the ones who wanted to take the grants went off and took the grants, and it just turned into a huge, you know, it was like walking into saltwater taffy and ultimately sort of died on the vine.
Right.
And the others went off and went back to doing, you know, what they could and what they were doing. But it was, you know, it was exactly a split. And it's happened to me so many times, Chuck, because you get these people get their look in their eye like, oh, money, free money.
Right.
It's like the brain goes and you think, well, wait a minute, you know, and ultimately it kills the momentum locally. I'll tell you one other story. It's somewhere in the sort of the middle of the Depression. We have 3,100 counties in America, and there were 3,100 local currencies. And then the New Deal got passed, and all of a sudden there were no local currencies. You know, basically they flooded with the central money. So the question is, how can we take responsibility if the printing presses are still rolling? And that's what I think a lot about. What really enthuses me about your book and your efforts is I think there's so many people in so many towns who are prepared to go to work and take responsibility, doing what they can with what they've got. That's where we've got to start. So I wanted to just ask.
That's a truth. Very, very much so. I would agree with that.
Yeah.
The thing that I find is not the, you know, even being in some very, very poor places, is not the bitter, divided, ugly America that is so often depicted. But this like beautiful set of people who would just say like, I'm ready to do this in my place. Like I'm ready to take responsibility, ownership. Like just get out of my way and let me do things.
So I wanted to ask you, what are some of the areas? Because I find food is one of the critical areas. Traffic is clearly one of the areas. What are some of the areas where you think towns are getting things done now?
Food is one that you mentioned, and I think it's important to understand why food is at the top of the list. Food is now something that you can economically do locally and have a higher quality product. So in other words, it's one of those things where you can actually have higher quality food at a lower price with more wealth kept locally. And so to me, it's like, it's the first logical kind of marble to start rolling here in this decentralization. So the places where you travel around and see local food, what you're seeing is essentially like a market vacuum where people are reasserting themselves into the marketplace. I'm going to say this one, and I this one's kind of hit and miss, but the places I've seen it done well, it's beautiful. I don't like the term tiny homes, But I think when I say tiny homes, people understand more what I'm talking about. The idea that we can build places for people where they can start small and then incrementally grow them over time, the way that, you know, humans did for thousands of years. My grandma's house growing up was a little tiny box that had an addition and then another addition and then a second story. This is a way for people to not have to go to the 30-year mortgage market and build the, you know, 3,000-foot finished product, but to actually start with something more compatible with their resources and then build that over time. There's a lot of cities that are now starting to allow that in ways they haven't before. And I think the results have been beautiful.
I think this is a great area. I remember once looking at the median price of a house in America, and it turned out essentially 100% of the increase had come from monetary inflation and bigger square footage.
Yes.
So, and if you go back and look at sort of what the square footage was before, we were a lot wealthier when we didn't get ahead of ourselves instead of in square footage. So I think this is really,
this is the funny thing. I think there's some deep human psychology here that I, you know, don't fully understand. But I mean, if you go back and look at the theory after World War II, the idea was that we would drive down the square foot cost of homes and that would make housing cheaper. And what actually happened instead is that we drove down the square foot cost of homes by building cheaper homes. And what we did in exchange is just increase the house size. So the house costs the same. You just get kind of a junkier house, but it's bigger. And sadly, that seems very American to me, you know?
Well, I remember reading the 2008 housing bill. Yeah. It's a couple hundred pages. I was sitting in the den. I called my attorney, who has worked a lot. She and I have done a lot with mortgage fraud and mortgage servicing fraud, which is very expensive and time consuming. It's astonishing how much of this goes on. And she had, at that point, her son was 16, and over at the farm, they were giving a home building course. I called her and I said, you know, having read this bill, what I'm going to tell you, if you're Christian's age, that's her son's name is Christian, I said, it is easier and cheaper to learn how to build your own house than to deal with a mortgage system.
Right.
So, I think the time has come to, you know, think in terms of very, you know, approach your housing as though the cost of capital, the real cost of capital and the cost of your time is, you know, much higher than you think it is. So I'm with you. I think that's great. Let me bring up one other risk, and that is, I think if you look at what's happening with the Internet of Things and Opportunity Zones and various ideas about, you know, delivering energy from space and all sorts of new technology, there's going to be a real push to try and privatize municipalities. And when they come in and do that, of course, with 0% cost of capital, they're going to say, oh, infrastructure isn't efficient, so, you know, we don't have to have a water system here. But it's going to be used as an abrogation of basically municipal obligations. And so basically, if you look at how the money works, you know, the guys coming in have basically, you know, are financing what they're doing with money pulled out of our credit one way or another. And yet they're going to try and abrogate the basic services or obligations. So I'm concerned about municipal privatization. Any thoughts?
I would add to that. I think one of the pernicious things we've done, and again, I think this is both political parties. We have made local government, and I'm going to use the word impotent. We've made them into glorified dog catchers. I call the state and federal government like the helicopter parents of local government. they really are kind of, you know, the knock on a helicopter parent is that you're doing everything for your child and you're not allowing them to grow and become their own person. And, you know, the end result of that is you wind up with an adult baby, someone you have to take care of all the time. And, you know, local governments today struggle and they try hard and they've got a lot of things that you know, there's a lot of good people working in local government. But what we've done is we've taken away a lot of their tools, a lot of their capacity to be innovative.
Right.
You know, and so in a sense, we've made them ineffective in a lot of ways. And I can see the end result of that being one of two things. One, in a sense, consolidation and centralization. So we're going to run more and more things from the state capital in Washington, D.C., because local government can't be trusted. They're just incompetent. And then on the other side of the coin, we're going to have corporations and you know, private players run aspects of local government because local government's just incompetent and they can't do it. I think both of those are really bad outcomes, really bad outcomes.
Right, right.
And they destroy our capacity to work together as people to solve problems. And that's what local government should be about. And the more we strip our cities of that power, I think the more of a disservice we do to not only our future, but, you know, our republic. It's just not the way things should run.
One of my favorite Joel Salatin books is called, he's a farmer in Virginia, if you don't know him, it's called Everything I Want to Do is Illegal. And if you ever go to Joel Salatin's workshops, basically what he describes is he and his family have, you know, he's a lovely guy. He's very charming and very positive. They have just laid siege to the regulators, their state and local regulators, again and again and again. It reminds me when I was on Wall Street, you know, we used to have this expression just of being absolutely, you know, overwhelming, relentless pressure, never give up. Right. And I think, you know, part of taking responsibility from the bottom up is you're going to have to work bottom up to back up the tsunami. And what's really interesting is it can be done. When I was making the community wizard tool, what I was trying to do was provide enough information and sort of intelligence about how the money worked so that a local person could prove that they could, you know, create a home with an FHA foreclosure of $25,000 instead of the government spending $250,000 per unit. And if you're a local community and you're walking in and saying, look, we can do this for $50,000, you're spending $250,000, we can get a better result and do five instead of one. It's very hard if you're a government official to say, no, I'd rather spend five times as much money.
Right.
You know, transparency can shift the game, but it means, one, you're going to have to take responsibility, and two, you're going to have to work the system. It's a big time commitment. And but I know some towns, you know, especially because you got a lot of smart people who are now retired, you know, who are experienced.
Right.
So let's talk about where, because you have a lot of invites to go to a lot of places. Where's the interest coming from? Is it coming from rural? Is it coming from suburban? Is it coming from urban, or all of the above?
That's a fantastic question. It's actually all of the above. And it's funny because we plotted up on the map where all the requests we had for stops on the book tour came from. And it basically blocked out the entire U.S. I mean, it was everywhere.
That's wonderful. Yeah.
It is wonderful. It is wonderful. And I think the thing that we have found ourselves able to do, and I'm going to toot our own horn here for a second.
Please.
Well, it's not a very Minnesotan thing to do, but I've been reflecting on this. In this time of everybody at each other's throats, we seem to have tapped into a message and a way of talking about the future that crosses political divides, crosses racial divides, crosses economic divides, and gender divides. And we've created something that is, you know, very, not only exciting, but very inclusive of a broad spectrum of America.
So I just have to tell you this. When I used to be when I was working on community development right after I left Hamilton, I was on a listserv called the Institute for Civic Values in Philadelphia. They would take the Constitution and apply it to a neighborhood. It was a really wonderful group.
Sure, sure.
The guy, Ed Schwartz, had been on the city council. Anyway, there was a guy in Cleveland who I've never met. I just dealt with him online. He was a local community organizer. And whenever we discussed national politics, he and I disagreed adamantly 100% of the time. Whenever we talked about local anything, we agreed 100% of the time.
Yep.
Because it was all about how do we optimize precious time and resources locally.
Right.
And it just completely, ideology, you know, both of our ideologies came to the same result.
Right. I think that's the beautiful thing about local and local government and really localization. When we look at cities of the past, they were built by conservatives and liberals. They were built by,
right,
you know, people working together. And I've come to really appreciate the fact that, you know, if you have conservatives run everything, the trains will run on time, but it won't be a place filled with, you know, the kind of empathy and understanding that it, right, needs to be successful. But if you have, right, liberals run everything, you're going to get the opposite. I mean, you're going to have all kinds of empathy and all kinds of, you know, proportionality, but you're going to lose the capacity to actually function and get things done. It takes, right, a mix of personalities.
Right. It takes a balance.
It does. And I don't think it's, right, any, you know, huge mystery that this is how humans have evolved to basically have both, you know, and I think it's a broader spectrum than just binary, but to basically have people who are all kinds of places along these spectrums. And, you know, when we sit down and roll up our sleeves and work together, we actually can accomplish a lot, and all those different viewpoints become very important. When we reduce them down to two, and when we centralize it, and then we make it so it's a one-size-fits-all approach, now we're at each other's throats, and you can get politicians who can come in and essentially manipulate us into hating each other in ways that, you know, at the local level really doesn't reflect reality.
So in my experience, no one in Washington had any ideology. They would spout it,
right,
but everything was about money.
Right.
And, you know, it's basically power and money, and how do we get more central control? And everything was just another message on the pathway to more central control. And to me, that's, you know, more or less it's going to continue as long as you're free to print free money. But we're running out of that. You know, the runway is almost through. So, and I think that's why it's so important to take a deep breath and say, okay, time to see what we can get done. So let me just turn to Strong Towns for a second, because I want to make sure people know how to get the book. They know if their town is interested, how do they get you involved? Or if they just want to come and access the website and join up, how do they get involved? So walk us through, first of all, how do they get the book?
The book's for sale anywhere. So anywhere you can get a book. I have people asking me to write a book for a long time, and I kind of held out till I got the right agreement and the right distributor. So we went with Wiley & Sons Publishing, a major publishing house, and they've got the book everywhere. So your local bookstore will have it. All right. The national retailers will have it. You know, all the online retailers, and hopefully your library will have it too. And if they don't, ask.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point, because to me, a great library is something you definitely want to have. Okay, so how did they come to strongtowns.org? What do they do when they get to the site?
Strongtowns.org is our main way of getting our message out there is through media. And so we publish three articles a day, every weekday. We do three different podcast streams. We do a lot of video, and all that is shared right through strongtowns.org. We're also active on all the social media platforms, so we're continually sharing our stuff through there. We're trying to reach a million. We're reaching 2 million people last year. We're trying to double that this year.
So they can sign up for your email list, right?
They can, right from the website there, get on our email list. We'll send you kind of the highlights as they go. Yeah.
Yeah. And the podcast is all about sort of things related to making your town wonderful?
Absolutely. Yeah. We get a little technical at times and a little non-technical. So we try to do a little bit of both. We've got three different podcasts, so they have different formats, and you'll find one that suits you. That's our MO.
And so if somebody reads the book, signs up, once, you know, is getting involved using your website, and they just love it, and they say, how do I get you guys to come to my town? And because I want to get my neighbors educated. What's the next step?
Do this all the time. In fact, I'm heading to Shreveport tomorrow and to Nevada the week after that, and did, you know, 55 stops in the last 2.5 months of the year. So we're all over the country sharing this message in person with people, which is really kind of the most powerful way to start the conversation. If you just go to strongdowns.org and click on events, which is a part of the, one of the menus at the top, you will get a list of every place we're going to be in the coming months. And if yours is not on there, you can click on the little button there that says, bring us to your town. There's a little form to fill out, and we'll do what we can to make it happen.
So I think we need a Strong Towns Chautauqua. Do you know what a Chautauqua is?
Enlighten me. I know this. I know Chautauqua, the place Chautauqua.
There's a Chautauqua, New York, and now they do it in Chautauqua. But in the 20s, they used to send out streams of people. So think of it almost like a Shakespearean thing of lecturers, and they would string out and they would go from town to town. And so let's say you had five lecturers and one would be in this town and the four would be strung out in the four towns, and they just keep moving one town at a time and they just come through. And in fact, at one point, some of us were buying a bus and wanted to do a Chautauqua because I think we're going to help each other reinvent, you know, what a community is and how it works. And so the way I was going to do it was not just going to be lectures. It was going to be like theater and improv comedy. You know, it's kind of like a cross between Strong Towns with a little dash of revival and fun.
Yes.
So, we had a couple of big buses and off we were going to go, but, and unfortunately it got quashed. But I think, you know, to a certain extent, you know, we're going to have to reinvent ourselves, and it's going to take rebuilding that, you know, that sense of community and getting people in a room and talking about it. Anyway, so my vote would be a Strong Town Chautauqua, but I know you've got plenty on your plate. Well, Chuck, this has been absolutely terrific, and I would encourage everybody, get the book, check out the website, check out the podcast, and if you think your town is interested, you know, plug in and put them on the list, because I think I think a bottom-up responsibility revolution is the way to go, but we're going to have to do it by getting into the nuts and bolts. And I think you've done a great job of inspiring people to do that and showing them just a regular flow of great ideas, Chuck. And so I can't thank you enough for what you're doing. And if there's anything we at Solari can ever do to support your help, please let us know.
Well, thank you. I love the opportunity to chat with you again. It's always a pleasure. And like we said, Strong Towns, keep doing what you can. You're doing amazing work, and I'm grateful.
Yeah. Turtle forward.
Turtle forward. That's all our responsibility is to keep moving ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, Chuck, you have a great day.
Bye. Thank you. Take care.